This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Well, we've all heard the claims. Candy is bad for you. Chocolate is good for you. Drinking is bad for you. Red wine is good for you. Every week, it seems there's new research, often contradictory, promising a healthier life. Atkins, paleo, gluten-free, organic diets have become big business, but they've left consumers confused. What research should we believe, and which diets are sustainable and have lasting results? Here to explore some of the food myths is Steve Chaney. He's the author of Slaying the Food Myths, The Truth Behind the Headlines. He's a professor emeritus at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill's Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics, and he spent the past 40 years teaching medical school students about nutrition and metabolism. Welcome, Steve. Good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Now, we're all confused because we read the headlines every day about what's good for us, and it's often contradictory, but you found that even your medical students are confused about this. Is kind of what got you going on this, right?
Yeah, that's really what got me going, because the students would come into class, and this was one of the first classes they took in medical school, and they'd come in believing all these bizarre myths. And then I started giving public lectures, and I found the same sort of thing. And I said, you know, somebody really needs to try and clear this up.
What are the myths? Give us the biggest. Top 10.
Oh, the top 10. Well, there's the there's one that I love because it's the chocolate's going to help you lose weight. That's a myth. There are the sugar myths that you're told that all these sugars are going to kill you. They're terrible for you. And yet you've got the same sugars and the same amounts in healthy foods. It's really the food, not the sugar.
But tell us about this. For instance, chocolate. I mean, many of these myths are derived from some kind of research into some aspect of this food that then becomes this bigger-than-life kind of story about chocolate helping you lose weight. So what's going on here?
Well, I think the thing is, and I call it the secret that only scientists know, but it's not really a secret. But the scientific method is that we tend to try and test the limits. We try and contradict the existing paradigm. That's the strength of the scientific method. We're always challenging the existing paradigm. But what that means is for any subject, you're going to find articles, papers on both sides of every issue. And the people who just want to promote a point of view will select the study that supports their viewpoint. Scientists recognize that you really need to look at the preponderance of studies, and you also need to evaluate the strength of the studies, which are good studies, which are bad studies, before you make a decision.
So is that something that we can do? Because, again, I don't think you're suggesting here that we just give up on it, that all this science is a bunch of hooey, climate change, my nose, there's nothing to it. There's, you know, research on both sides. I don't have to believe that stuff. We do have to believe something. Is there something we can do to sort through and do the kind of filtering that you're suggesting we need to?
Well, I mean, sometimes it's just to look at the source. So, for example, saturated fats, that's a very interesting controversy. So on the one side, you've got the American Heart Association, National Institutes of Health, the CDC, the top cardiologists and heart experts in the country telling us that saturated fats are bad for your heart. On the other hand, you've got a variety of blogs who are, you know, they're claiming that saturated fats are good for you. And so you need to look at that and say, and they're trying to tell you the American Heart Association's lying to you.
Well, so, all right, so now what do I do? Because, you know, again, I think this goes back to the Atkins diet, some of these diets that say eat all the fat you want, you know, and just lay off the carbs, right? That's the mantra. And people go on these diets, and for 8 minutes they lose a few pounds, and they say, see, it worked. But it feels sort of intuitively like I really shouldn't just be pounding down all the saturated fat I possibly can. On the other hand, we worry perhaps too much about this over some period of time, some set of decades, where we said that, you know, the first slice of bacon will keel over of a heart attack. What I mean, so what's the truth in there must have been something in some report that's kind of true and taken to extremes has become a fad and then folly.
So when we look at the fats, so the example you were giving were the low carb diets. So any diet that's extreme, where you cut out whole food groups, you're going to lose weight. Part of that I call the cream cheese and bagel phenomenon. You know, it's great to say you can eat all the cream cheese you want, but eventually you're going to have a bagel to go with it. And you just cut back on the food you're eating naturally. But the other thing you're doing when you cut out whole food groups is really focus on what you're eating. And when you focus on what you're eating, you lose weight. And guess what? When you lose weight, your cholesterol levels come down. Your triglyceride levels come down, your blood sugar levels are improved, so it looks like you're getting healthier. But those are all short-term markers. What we really need to look at is health outcomes, heart attacks, strokes, diabetes, cancer over a 10 to 20-year period. When you do that, there's no evidence that the low-carb diets are healthy. Well, I take that back. I have finally found some studies showing that low-carb diets were healthy. It turns out they were all plant-based low-carb diets, not meat-based low-carb diets.
That's interesting. So it's what you eat, and it's remaining mindful, becoming mindful about what it is you're putting in your stomach. Because here's the thing that confuses a lot of us. I mean, part of it is the contradictory research over time. You know, we were told that, you know, eggs are bad for you, eggs are good for you, eat less meat, eat more meat. And there was actually a piece recently on Funny or Die, I think, that sort of illustrates the confusion that consumers have over this.
Wait! Stop! Don't eat that food!
Who are you? What are you doing in our house?
I'm from the future. I'm here to warn you, don't eat that food.
Why not?
The eggs, they're full of cholesterol.
Well, I guess I better take those eggs.
Wait! Stop!
You're back!
Yeah! We were wrong about the eggs.
How?
Well, it turns out there's two types of cholesterol. There's good cholesterol and bad cholesterol, and eggs actually have both. So you can eat eggs, but just don't eat the egg yolks. So stick with the egg whites.
Thank you.
Yeah. Godspeed! Wait! We were wrong about the eggs!
Again?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so it turns out that the amount of cholesterol in a food doesn't actually affect how much cholesterol ends up in your blood. The eggs are probably fine. In fact, we sort of don't even know what cholesterol is.
Here we go. A Funny or Die sketch called This Is Why Eating Is Hard. I'm talking to Steve Chaney. He spent 40 years at UNC teaching medical students about nutrition and metabolism, and he's got a new book called Slaying the Food Myths, The Truth Behind the Headlines. So this gets, I mean, there was some good research, you know, about cholesterol. And then, of course, science marches on and we refine this stuff. Does this tell us more about the progress of science or simply the complexity of the human body that isn't always taken into account?
Well, both. I mean, it's a complexity of science because we're constantly reevaluating studies and we look at them for different viewpoints. But yes, the human body is tremendously complex. And Frank, here is the important thing. None of us are average. I call it the Lake Wobegon effect, where all the kids are above average. You do a scientific study, and the scientific study gives you the average result. So let's say you do a scientific study, and you say people follow this diet for 6 weeks. They lose 5 pounds, 10 pounds, whatever it is. So let's say they've lost 10 pounds. Well, some people have lost more. Some people have lost less. Some people have actually gained weight. Nobody actually lost exactly 10 pounds.
Right. And because our metabolism is so different, this is part of the problem of testing for the effects of pesticides and some of the sort of industrial inputs that we're using, because it's not going to happen to everybody. Everybody's not going to drop dead of something. But if we all of a sudden see a rise in autoimmune or in endocrine disorders, we might make a correlation that we'll never be able to prove because we're so complex as individuals.
Yes, absolutely.
And what about, so why is eating so hard? Because here's the thing. As far as I can tell, human beings have been eating since the beginning of human beings. For millennia, we've been eating. And it's, and you know, they die of other things, but they didn't die of obesity. And diabetes are type 1, this is type 2. So what is it about modern living that has made eating so hard and, frankly, not that healthy? I mean, look at us. We're more food conscious than anybody on Earth, and we're also the fattest country on Earth. Obesity is an epidemic.
Well, there are lots of ways I could answer that, but let's talk about the food industry, big food. So if you think about it, breakfast cereals were originally a health food. Dr. Kellogg created this Battle Creek Sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan. This is where people flocked to eat healthy, to learn how to exercise, fresh air, all of the things that make you healthy. And he created Kellogg's Corn Flakes, which was designed to be a healthier alternative to the high-fat breakfast that Americans were eating. Well, what happened is various competitors came along, and they found out if you put a little bit of sugar in there, people would buy more. So you went from 5% sugar in Kellogg's Corn Flakes to 10%, to 20%, 40%. Now you can get sugar. Now you can get Cheerios with 60% sugar.
Mm.
Now, what parent would put down a bowl of cereal for their children and fill half of that bowl with sugar? Nobody.
Right. And so that was the double good that had to be added to Kellogg's in order to keep pace. But the marketing stays the same. It's always marketed as something healthy, a healthy breakfast. I remember the commercials back in the 60s that bragged about the fact to moms that this has double the food energy of any other breakfast cereal. And you think, boy, double the food. That's sugar, Mom. The food energy is sugar. Right. But the marketing, of course, is a big part of this. So the way industrial food production works, the way they want to cheapen all of the supply chain, and that means a lot of sugar and oils and that sort of thing.
Well, Frank, let me give you another example because it's really interesting. When the American Heart Association first came out years ago and said that we need to reduce the amount of fat and saturated fat in the diet, what they had in mind was a diet in which we had more fresh fruits and vegetables, legumes, whole foods. And what happened is the food industry stepped in and said, well, golly, if the Americans started doing that, our profits would decrease. So they said, well, wait a minute here. We'll make all your favorite foods fat-free. So just put in some more sugar, some more right. refined carbs, a few chemicals, and, you know.
Well, this also has to do with, again, this whole question of the way the market then catches up, the way the industry figures out what's going on. I mean, if you think about trends like the need for gluten-free. There are people who have gluten allergies, and so for them, gluten-free food is very important. This is a good thing for them. So then food manufacturers start stamping gluten-free, you know, on like your aluminum windows to sell this stuff, and then people start thinking, because they see it all over, oh, gluten-free must be healthy for it. There must be some health benefit to gluten-freeness, right? I mean, this is the kind of thing, right?
Yes. Now, one of the things I will say, I have gluten sensitivity,
yeah.
So
it's a real thing.
It is a real thing. I don't have the allergy, but I have gluten sensitivity.
Yeah.
We don't quite understand why that is increasing, but it is increasing. There are an increasing number of people who are sensitive to gluten. There are theories about that, but they're theories, so I won't honor them here.
But I'm talking about the marketing. When people show up at the store and say, oh, well, I should eat gluten-free because obviously that's some other good health thing for me.
Gluten-free can be healthy if you're eating whole foods. If you're eating gluten-free processed foods, forget it.
So there you go. Tell me more about this, though. What do you think we should be doing? I mean, is there anything out there? Because I say we've been eating for millennia, and it got us here. So apparently we knew how to do this once. Are there some rules that we could probably follow and stay pretty healthy?
Well, if you look at the evidence, primarily plant-based diets are the healthiest. Those are the ones where we know if you follow for 10, 20, 30 years— reduced heart attacks, reduced stroke, reduced cancer, reduced diabetes. So we have definite health benefits. But that ranges all the way from vegan to Mediterranean, something called the DASH diet to stop hypertension.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these are all diets. Some of them have meat in them, but it's small amounts of meat in a primarily plant-based setting.
And again, you've got to understand what you're doing then, because you've got to balance amino acids and some other things that you make sure you're getting the right levels of all the nutrients that we absolutely need, right?
Yes, but, I mean it's not as hard as you might think, particularly if you stick with the good vegetarian protein sources, the legumes, whole grains, fresh fruits and vegetables, you're going to balance out your amino acids pretty well.
And that's because we really kind of know what we're doing, right? I mean, we would start getting hungry for the right things if we would have let our bodies adjust to a more healthy diet, which you say is really more whole foods and largely plant-based.
And again, it's eating a variety of foods. It's when we get hung up and say, I can just eat a few foods. I have to give up all these different foods, but I can eat only a few foods. That's where we start to run into trouble. That's where we start restricting, we start developing nutritional deficiencies. We may or may not be getting enough fiber. We start to run into trouble when we restrict the foods that we eat.
Now, even when we're talking about whole foods, and I'm talking about the quality of the food and not where you buy them, and natural foods, we have to start worrying here because again, the industrial food supply, they're being modified so quickly. And you talk about GMO, which, again, we've gotten a little bit, you think, we've gone a little overboard on our concern about GMO.
Well, so I think the concern about GMO is real. You know, you've genetically modified the DNA. There's a possibility that that may have consequences. We don't have any actual examples, but theoretically possible. But you've also modified the proteins. And anytime you have a modified protein in a food, you can have food allergies to that. And that's very hard to quantify. So we think that's a possibility, but we really don't know to what extent that occurs. But once you start purifying sugars or oils, that sort of thing, away from the genetically modified food, you've removed all the genetic material. You've removed all the protein. Those are, you know, chemically and biologically indistinguishable, whether they come from GMO or non-GMO. So this idea that you have to label everything GMO, if it came originally from a GMO food, that's where I think we've gone too far.
All right. And, well, I appreciate it. It's great stuff. Steve Chaney is the author of Slaying the Food Myths, The Truth Behind the Headlines. He's a professor emeritus at UNC Chapel Hill's Department of Biochemistry and Biophysics. Going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on Thursday, June 21st, 7 o'clock, for a reading and a signing. And we've got that at our website, stateofthings.org. What a pleasure. Steve, thank you so much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.